Om Pattaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamana Santadami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. Verse 11.
Mm-hmm.
Of chapter 17. We're going to start. We went through the sattva, rajas, and tamas types of ahara, of food. Right? So now we're going to go the sattva, rajas, and tamas types of yajna, of ritual, okay? Of karma. Yeah. Apala kankshibhir yajna vididrishto ya ijyate Yashtavyam me veti manaha Samadhaya sasatvikaha Apala akankshi bihi yajnaha Vidhi drishtaha yaha ijyate Yashtavyam eva iti manaha samadhaya saha sattvikaha. The yajnaha vididrishtaha yaha ijyate. The one who performs, ij means to perform a ritual. Okay, so yaha ijyate, or no, it would go like this in the passive. Which yajna, yajnaha vididrishtaha yaha ijyate. The yajna, the ritual, which is performed, ijyate, which with the yajnaha yaha ijyate, the yajna which is performed, vididrishtaha, keeping in view, understanding the viddhi. Means according to the Shastra Viddhi. Viddhi means the rules. The Viddhis are the rules, the requirements. When a given ritual, say you're going to perform a ritual, the Agnihotra ritual, or any of the rituals that are being enjoined, say you want to perform the ritual, well, exactly how that ritual is to be performed is written out very, very clearly in the Vedas. So it's any yajna is Vaidika. It's born of the Vedas. The Vedas tell you how to perform those rituals. So if somebody is performing a ritual, the sattvika buddhi, sattva, they're performing it in accordance with the rules of the... they're in accordance with the Vedas, exactly how the Vedas tell you to perform that ritual. They follow that very clearly. So that's the viddhi drishtaha. It is seen, that yajna is done, we say, is done keeping in view the viddhis, means the injunctions, you know, the injunctions and the description of how to do it properly as told in the Vedas. So, and that yajna, that ritual is done by those who, akankshikaha means an expectation or desire. So an akankshin is one who has an expectation or a desire. So here it says, these rituals that are performed according to viddhi, without a desire for the pala. See, it says apala, that unnegates. Pala is the fruit. So say a ritual, a Vedic ritual, there's really two types of Vedic rituals that are enjoined in the Vedas. One are called, there's more than that, but two major types. the nitya karmas, rituals that are to be done daily, and naimittika karmas, rituals that are to be done on occasion. So as, depending upon your caste or what stage of life you're in, certain rituals are, even daily rituals, are enjoined upon you. And also certain rituals, like for instance, birthdays, or when a child has their first tooth or speaks their first word, you know, and when they reach a certain age, there's a different upanayana ceremonies that are done, there's marriage ceremonies, there's ceremonies that are, when a person dies, shraddha, there's things that are done every year. So these are all naimittika karmas. So these naimittika karmas have to be done on certain occasions. Then there's nitya karmas that need to be done on a daily basis. Then there's prayaschitta karmas that are done. Prayaschitta means karmas to neutralize negative karmas that you've done. But all of these karmas, then there's kamya karmas, karmas that are done in order to fill a certain desire. Say you want to go to Swargaloka, or you want your child to become well, or you want it to rain outside. Those are kamya karmas, karmas that are done and rituals that are done in order to gain a particular result, you know, to have a like putra kameshti, which is always putra kameshti, the desire to have a child, is putra kameshti, or the desire to go to swarga, the desire to bring the rains, the desire to get rid of drought. We have karmas for rituals for all of these things. Those are called kamya karmas. So here, for somebody who's the rituals that they're performing are considered sattvic, this starts out by saying, first of all, those rituals are done in following the vidhis of the Veda. That's one thing. And they're done by a person who is not asking for any pala, any result for themselves. I'll get into what that means in a minute. The apala means without any result. They're doing the ritual, not asking for any particular result. Then they're doing it with manasamadhaya, with a mind that is resolved, with a meditative mind, a mind that is resolved, and that has the sankalpa. Why are they doing it? They're not doing it for any particular result, not so they can go to heaven, or not so that they can accrue punya, so that they can get a better next birth, or not so that they can bring the rains. They're not doing it for any particular they're not doing it for a specific reason. What is their thinking then? Yeshtavyam eva iti. This ritual, this yajna, is to be done by me. Why? Because it's enjoined by the Vedas as my nitya karma. These are the karmas that Bhagavan asked me to do on a daily basis. And these are the karmas that Bhagavan asked me to do on an occasional basis. So these are the things, having Shraddha in the Vedas, these are the karmas that are enjoined on me to do. And because they're enjoined on me to do, therefore I do them. I'm not doing them in order to accrue any punya or to go to heaven or to anything like that. I'm doing them because Bhagavan has asked me to do them. Okay? Now, why would I do that? So when we go to a different level, because this is coming up in the Bhagavad Gita and Arjuna and Krishna is teaching Arjuna, that buddhi is really the karma yoga buddhi. It's the karma yoga buddhi. So, what is the Dharma? So we can say it more generally like this. What is the Dharma in this particular situation? That Dharma is what is enjoined upon me to do. That Dharma is Bhagavan. And so by following the Dharma, any given situation or any given ritual that's enjoined on me to do, I do that ritual as an arpana, Ishvara arpana buddhi, as really worship for Bhagavan. And then what do I actually get out of it doing that is antakarana shuddhi. If I get anything out of it, it's antakarana shuddhi, means purity of mind. A mind that has a resolve. And why do I want purity of mind? Okay. For moksha. That Ishvara arpana buddhi, what is moksha really? That's why in the previous verse, if you remember in the previous very famous verse where Bhagavan talks about the four types of devotees, the four types of bhaktas, one bhakta is the arati. It's the one who, when things get bad, things are really rough, and you say, oh, Bhagwan, now I need you. Please come and help me. Otherwise, you're too busy. You don't think about Bhagwan at all. Then there's the Artharthi. That one thinks, I'm beginning something new. Let me call on Bhagwan to give his grace and blessings. The Artharthi doesn't think about that. The Artharthi, it's only when things are going bad when Bhagwan comes to his mind. The Artharthi, it's when things are going bad, Bhagwan will come to his mind. But whenever there's a new beginning, or you want Bhagwan's blessings for some sort of new beginning, then you pray to Bhagwan, please, please come and bless this. Any new beginning. That's the Artharthi. Or you want something, please, Bhagwan, please bless me with this. But it's all asking. It's not about, Bhagwan, I want to know you. It's, Bhagwan, you're there. Whatever you are, please help me. Please let, I know you're there. You're there, so please come and take care of me. Please help me to fulfill my desires. Basically, that's what it is. Another type of bhakta, which is the mumukshu. The mumukshu is the one who, as Bhagavan will say, the one who wants to know me. That's another type of bhakta, you know. Bhagavan, you are who I want to know. I want to know you. That's, now we're getting into the world of the mumukshu. I want to know you. And the fourth type of bhakta is the one who knows me. The one who knows me is the one who is me. That's the jnani. So you have the Artharthi, one in trouble, then the Artharthi, the one who wants to help to fulfill the desires, the mumukshu, now the one who wants me, wants to know me, then the jignasu, the one who has a desire to know me, and then the jnani, the one who knows, who does know me. And of those four, the one that is most dear to me, one who's most dear to me, is the jnani. The reason that the jnani is the most dear to me is because the jnani is me. The jnani is me. And why would that be most dear to me? Because my very swarupa is ananda. And there is nothing more dear than ananda. You see, there's kind of a little twist there. The jnani is the most dear to me, because the jnani is me, and that me is ananda, that wholeness, that fullness, that absolute fullness, and there is nothing more dear than that in the whole creation. All beings love only that. All beings love only that ananda, but that ananda is superimposed on other objects, and then you run after it. But what you're running after, you must think, it exists in the object, or you think it exists in the situation, and so you run after that situation. You're not running after the situation or the person. You're running after the ananda. And the jnani is the one who has found the ananda. But in finding the ananda, what they have found is that the ananda is my very being. And the very being that I am is the being that Bhagavan is. And so the one who is the most dear to me is the one who knows me, and knows me, is me. And that me is the very ananda that all beings seek. And so here, the one who has given up, see, to do a ritual without any desire for the pala, in terms of, for the fruit of it, in terms of accomplishing something or attaining something in the world, somebody has given up any desire, and yet they continue to do the ritual, then what is the underlying desire of doing that ritual? Why are they doing it? Why are they doing the ritual? For nothing. They're not doing the ritual for nothing. They're doing the ritual as an arpana, as a worship of Ishwara, of Bhagavan. That's why they're doing the ritual. But why are they worshipping Ishwara in that way? What do they want from Ishwara in the performance of this ritual or in a commitment to Dharma? Why? Because it brings about the Antakarana Shuddhi, which allows them to know me. That is what's required for moksha. You know? And so it's the mumukshu that does these, that continues to do these rituals, but now not for desire of the fruits of the action or anything like that, because they already have the viveka and the vairagya, they have the mumukshutvam. And now what they want is to do dharma and have their mind committed to dharma, so that in committing the mind to dharma, there's no longer any raga dvesha. There's a neutralization of raga dvesha. Your life is no longer about likes and dislikes. I need this to be happy. I need that to be happy. That's given up. The whole life now is just an expression of dharma, so that my mind has neutralizes these likes and dislikes, so it has the freedom to do the shravana, manana, nitta, dhyasana, to has the freedom to really listen, to understand, and to recognize my own being. So that is the most that is the sattvika buddhi. So he says the one who does it in that way, keeping the mind resolved in a meditative stance, I mean, this ritual is to be done by me, this is enjoined by me, let me do it. You can extend it. This karma is enjoined by me, because Krishna is talking to Arjuna. Arjuna's a kshatriya. He's not going to be doing rituals. But he is, he has to do his dharma as a kshatriya, and he has to fight this war, right? So he has dharmas that he himself has to do. So those dharmas that are enjoined by me, those duties that are enjoined upon you, you do those duties, keeping your mind resolved in with me, to the resolved mind. It's really very beautiful. That's a sattvika buddhi. So let's see what the rajasa buddhi is. Abhisandhaya tupalam, abhisandhaya tupalam, dambaratam apichayavayat, dambaratam apichayavayat, ijyate bharata shreshta, ijyate bharata shreshta, tam yajnam vidirajasam, tam yajnam vidirajasam, abhisandhaya tupalam, dambaratam, dambha artham api chaivayat idyate bharata shreshta tam yajnam vidhi rajasam. Vidhi rajasam, may you know that yajna, yajnam, tam yajnam, that yajna, vidhi, may you know that yajna as rajasic, tam yajnam vidhi rajasam. What is that? So he says, abhisandhaya tu, whereas, keeping your eye, abhisandhaya, on the fruit. One who's keeping their eye or their drishti, you know, their commitment is on gaining the pala, gaining the result of the karma. So keeping in view the karma, dambaratam api, and also doing it aratam for the sake of, so abhisandhaya, keeping in view, it's for the sake of the pala, or for the sake of dhamma. Dhamma is that quality where you're faking it. It's a hypocrisy. It's saying it's important to me that you see me as a religious person. And so I do all kinds of rituals and prayers. I call you to the house to do bhajans and singing. I do all kinds of things, but why? What's the motivation? Well, so that you will respect me as a religious person. That's the motivation. It's a hypocrisy. It has nothing to do with any commitment to the ritual or any bhakti toward the bhajans or anything like that. It's that the commitment is to dhamma. Dhamma means hypocrisy. In the Amanitvam, in the chapter 13, we have a whole list. Amanitvam, Adambitvam, Ahimsa, Kshanti, Arjava, all of these. Amanitvam is the first one, which just means kind of that name-dropping, pride, showing off about your good qualities that are actually there. Dhamma is the hypocrisy, making people think you have those qualities or believe that you have a certain amount of power, or believe you have a certain amount of education, or believe you have a certain amount of money, when you don't. And so here it would be, in this context, you're doing these rituals so that you can gain the fruits, gain Swargaloka, or, you know, gain a family member, or gain wealth, or whatever it is, that there's many, many rituals, and you're doing them according to the Vidipiya, but you want the pala, your eye is on the pala. And it's not that you're particularly religious or spiritual, but it's to your advantage that people think you are. That's the Dambartam. So keeping your eye on the result, and also the hypocrisy, where you're pretending to be as a religious person. So it's that you're hypocritical. Ijite, the yajna, which is done, keeping ijite tam yajnam, that which is done, that yajna, that yajna, which is done, keeping in view the result, and that has that hypocritical aspect to it. Hey, Bharata Shrestha, you, Krishna, who are Shrestha, the most exalted, you know, in Bharata, in the land, Bharata Shrestha, know that type of yajna to be rajasic, that type of ritual to be rajasic. Because it's the motives. It's not the yajna, it's the motives with which you're doing it. And so those are rajasic motives. Let's do the tamasic one. Vidihinam ashrishtanam, vidihinam ashrishtanam, mantrahinam adakshinam, mantrahinam adakshinam, shraddha virahitam yajnam, tamasam parichakshate. Tamasam parichakshate. He said the yajna which is considered to be tamas, which is stated as being tamas, yajnam tamasam parichakshate, the one that is told as tamas, is this. It is vidyahinam, means it's not really following any vidhi. The Shastra has very specific vidhis, rules and injunctions for how to perform the ritual. The one who's doing the ritual in a tamasic is with a tamasic attitude, he just does the ritual, doesn't pay very much attention to the vidhis and the requirements for the Vedic requirements for doing that ritual properly. So hinam means it's not really following the vidhi. Ashrishta anam. You know, when these rituals and karmas are done, all of the brahmanas, the priests, and various people are supposed to be fed. When you do a ritual, then you feed the people that are involved in the ritual and the people that are attending it and the brahmanas and the priests that are, they're supposed to be fed. So, ashrishta annam. In this case, there's no food. That feeding, you know, when you feed someone, you make them full. Right? Food is very important. If you feed somebody, they become full and content. When a ritual is done, then you feed all of the people, you know, that are there, and they become full and content. Then there's another thing. Mantra. So this annam, the giving of the food, is important part of all of these rituals. Another one is mantrahinam. Mantrahinam, you can say it's without the mantras. But of course they're chanting the mantras, but if a mantra is not chanted properly according to swara and it's mispronounced, it's not a mantra. You're just saying something, but it's not a mantra. The mantra, the swaras, and saying the proper pronunciation, all of that is very important. That's why we make sankalpa, saying to Bhagavan, please accept this mantra as being chanted with proper swaras and proper pronunciation, you know, in order to protect the mantra, the mantraness of the mantra, you know. And then you try to the best of your ability to properly chant the mantra, to say it as, according to the swaras, and to make long ahs and short ahs and ee and aspirate sounds and non-aspirate, to actually learn proper pronunciation and do the mantra properly according to swara. So mantra hina means the vidhi, the ritual, the yajna is being done not paying careful attention to the mantra, not following all of the injunctions, not feeding the people that are meant to be fed. And another thing is adakshinam. Every ritual, every yajna has as part of it dakshinam. Dakshinam means you give to the priests and to the priest, and also it can be to the surrounding brahmanas. You give them something that has to do with wealth. You can give them money, you can give them cattle, you can give them something that improves their wealth. And so that dakshina, unless the dakshina has been given, that ritual is considered not to be a ritual. It doesn't mean that you have to, that it is a huge amount or a little amount. It's just an appropriate amount, and that's considered as an actual part of the yajna. So adakshinam means no dakshina has been given. Shraddha virahitam. Virahitam means without. There's no shraddha. That's interesting. Say you're doing a ritual, but you have no shraddha in the ritual. Shraddha means that your heart is involved. There's something that you believe that this ritual is sacred and important and of value. Yeah? What if there's no shraddha? Then it's kind of hard to understand why the ritual is even being done in the first place. So you're doing it in a sloppy fashion, vidhi, not following the vidhi. You're not doing any of the what we call the samanya, the general rules around doing any ritual. You have to give food, you have to give dakshina. Even the Westerners know this. you have to give food, you have to give dakshina, your pronunciation is important, this mantra hinam, we all know that. And then there's also no shraddha. Then what are you doing? So it'd be like, like your parents make you go to church. I was very tamas. Parents make you go to church and they force you to sit in the pews and you're supposed to be really still and quiet and listen and pay attention, but you have absolutely no interest and you're just squirming around, and all of these, if the mass is going on and the sacred host is being passed out and it means absolutely nothing to you, but for whatever reason you have to be there, and so you're just going through the motions and waiting for it to be over. That's the tamas. So if you're not being forced to be there, if you're not being forced to do it, why would you even do it if there's no shraddha? So you're stuck in the situation and you have to go to church, you have to go to mass, you have to go to the ritual, you have to go to temple. So you go to temple and you just go through the motions, but there's nothing in you that cares about it. The key is there, the no shraddha. So there's no shraddha, then why would any of it mean anything to you? Shraddha means, that it's held as sacred. And it's something that you're committed to, that you believe in, that has a great value. That's what shraddha means. It has a value for you. If there's no shraddha, then what is it? It's nothing. Somebody's just making you go, or you're just going through the motions. Something to do. Maybe because you get some free food at the end or whatever. who knows? But that's the tamas for the yajna. Okay. Now, I'm going to do a couple more. The next ones are, they have to do with tapas. And what they're going to do first is look at tapas. I'm just going to do two verses here, and maybe just at least do one and start on the other. But this is the structure. First, they're going to look at tapas, austerities, from the standpoint of the sharira, the body, and then vak tapas, from the standpoint of the voice, and then manasa tapas, mental, from the standpoint of the mind. Then after that, they go and they look at the sattvika and rajas and tamas, in terms of tapas. But first they look at the different types of tapas. So the tapas that austerities and disciplines that have to do from the standpoint of the physical body. So that's this one here. So it says threefold, the body, vak, speech, and the mind. So Deva Dvija Guru Prajna. Deva Dvija Guru Prajna. Pujanam Shaucham Arjavam. Pujanam Shaucham Arjavam. Brahmacharyam Ahimsacha. Brahmacharyam Ahimsacha. Shariram Tapa Uchyate. Shariram Tapa Uchyate. Deva Dvija. Deva, Dvija, Guru, Prajna, Pujanam, Shaucham, Arjavam, Brahmacharyam, Ahimsa, Cha, Shariram, Tapa, Uchate. This tapas, this discipline, spiritual discipline, in reference to the body, Shariram, body means Sharira. It's okay.
That hero going well.
I just got adrenaline.
It's interesting.
Someone's mic on?
No, it can't be. I have everybody muted.
Oh, let's start over now.
Sound is foggy. Okay. The word for body is shariram, short rasha. Shariram means belonging to the body, in reference to the body. So shariram tapaha, tapas, those spiritual austerities or disciplines or commitments that are related to the physical body. So first when he says deva, deva means the god, Ishwara, or the devatas, the Ishwara, or the devas, devatas. Dvija, the brahmanas. Why they say the brahmanas is because the brahmanas are holding the Vedas. They're holding the Vedic culture. They're the priests and the educators and the one who pass on the dharma of the Vedas. So the dvijas, the brahmanas. The gurus. The gurus, the guru are the teachers. It's your spiritual teacher, but it's also the teachers that you grow up with in any subject matter is a guru, not just the spiritual teacher. The guru is also, like if you're a musician, that person, the teacher will be your guru, right? If you're an astrologer, the teacher will be your guru. So whoever are your teachers, those people. Prajna. Prajna are the wise people, those people that have wisdom, the jnanis, and the people who generally, dharmanishtas, those people that have wisdom are those people. Pujanam. Those people... Your attitude toward them is one of puja. Puja means of tremendous respect. You honor them. You worship them, not in a kind of a Western way. You hold them in very high regard. You respect them. You know, you honor them. Those type of people, Bhagawan, the brahmanas, right? The gurus, your teachers. And those people that are esteemed as having wisdom. The next one is shaucham. You keep the body clean. We're talking now pisharirum. You keep the body clean, the clothes clean, and your environment clean. In India, especially, you know, the brahmanas and the students keeping yourself clean and fresh and your room clean and all of that is really considered very important, because if you have the discipline outside, then it affects the inside. So just like you know how when you clean your house, you cleaned your kitchen, you cleaned your house, everything, you've done all the laundry and everything, it feels different. When your house is clean and fresh, when your body is clean and fresh, your clothes, it's clean clothes, not dirt clothes. So that shaucham is considered important for, that's a discipline for having that clarity, that antakarana shuddhi, that purity of, it affects your mind in a positive way. So it's a discipline. I know Swamiji and he always, of course, every morning he has his shower and a fresh dhoti goes on. Okay? Every afternoon he has his shower, a fresh dhoti goes on. So he's always fresh. You know, and you see that many of the sannyasis also follow him in that, where that cleanliness is always there. So that shaucham, Adarjavam. Adarjavam, we'll see this in the Vaktapas in much more detail, but Adarjavam has to do with telling the truth, being straightforward. Arjavam means on a physical level that you do what you say you're going to do.
Yeah.
It's that honesty. And so that the way to think of Arjavam is that there's a straight line. It's like it means not crooked, right? It's a straight line between your mind, your speech, and your action. So that everything is, there's no conflict anywhere. And so the actions, the things that you do, are backed by the things that you say and the things that you think. So Arjavam from a physical standpoint, how I conduct myself in the world should be true and honest and straightforward. So my behavior is Arjavam, is straightforward. Brahmacharyam. Brahmacharyam means all of the disciplines of a student of a brahmachari. Means that my shama, dhamma, upariti, tatiksha, all of these things stand out for me. And also that I keep myself within dharma sexually. So that brahmacharya for a brahmachari, there's celibacy. For a grihastha, there's a relationship that you have with your partner. There's not looseness around your sexual behavior. It's not that you have to be celibate. You have to be celibate if you take the vows of celibacy. It's not as though you have to be celibate to have self-knowledge. But you have to control your passion. Now, how do you control your passion? So sexuality is one very strong passion. But also your raga dveshas are very strong, where I don't have control of my desires. So the desires control me, I don't control the desires. The desires say yes, you know, but there's no one inside to say no. And so a brahmacharya means I'm the one that says yes or no to all of the passions and forces that rise up into the antakarana. That's the brahmacharya. There's a commitment to dharma and to being able to be the one who holds the reins of my mind and my sense organs. If I'm not holding the reins, then that's a sadhana. I have to be able to see. If I have the values, those brahmachari values, then I see when I'm not holding the reins, when the horses are running wild, as the example they use in the Gita, poor, though the guy in the back seat of the chariot is just being taken on this wild ride, the buddhi, you know, is as though drunk and is not able to hold the reins and the sense organs, the horses, which are the sense organs, are just running rampant.
Reckless.
They're taking you. That's all. So the buddhi has to be able to have shama and have dhamma. You know, shama means everything's in order. You know, and if something is rising up that is not something I feel to go with, I can just let it go. That's shama. I can dismiss thoughts and moods and feelings. If they don't kind of agree with my value system, I can let them go. And you can do that for 90% of the time. Look at how many thoughts you have that just naturally you just let go, or feelings that don't grab you. Dhamma comes in when the feelings overwhelm you. Then you have to be able to contain them and not act them out. Like you have to hang on to the reins. A lot of times if it's too much, we lose the reins. And the horses are just running wild. And there's nobody left to say yes or no. That's the lack of brahmacharya there. And so those things, when I have passions that are taking me away from my values, then those are things that I have to work on. Part of this all is consciousness. I have to understand. I have to be conscious that this happens. And the buddhi has to be educated to know that this is what happens, and when this happens, then I should bring back the reins. You know, I should be able to say yes or no. That's the job of the buddhi. If I can't, then my mind, I need to work with my mind a little bit, you know, and bring it back under my control. So that brahmacharya is good. The other one is ahimsa. We're on a physical level here now, shariram tapas. Ahimsa means non-injury. We'll wait till we get to the vaktapas and the mind. It's so beautiful. We'll do it next week. Ahimsa means non-injury. Let me not hurt any living being. That's what it is. May I not hurt any living being. May I not hurt another human being. May I not hurt an animal. May I not hurt the insects. Swamiji even used an example. I've seen him do this. I do this also. I do this out of feeling now, but I used to do it just because he did it, and he was my role model for many years. But if there's an ant in the shower, it takes you, 15 seconds to get the ant and put it out the window, to free it. That's all it takes. So that's ahimsa. When you have a choice to save it or to kill it, then save it.
Mm.
That's ahimsa.
Mm.
And why not?
Mm.
That's a beautiful discipline to whatever degree that you can do it. There's always these lines drawn, right? That's what the giants go so far, where they wear masks, so they don't breathe in animals, and then they walk around with a very delicate little broom so that they don't step on anything. So there are limits. But when you have a choice to not harm another living being, then choose not to. That's ahimsa. Swamiji won't even pick a flower. So to get the sensitivity, because why pick the flower when it's so beautiful on the vine? Why are you picking it? Is it necessary? That's what you have to think. That's a consciousness. Why are you stepping on, when you're walking along, you're stepping on thoughtlessly on the flowers? It's not necessary. You can, if you're trampling through the, say you're walking through a meadow and you're trampling through all of the wheat and everything, that's what's happening there. But when you have a choice, then why not choose to protect the living beings, including the plants and the animals and humans? It's a beautiful sadhana. It makes you more sensitive, because you also start to realize, that those beings want to live like you do. They want to live. They have families. They have relationships. I'm even studying plants now. Plants have relationships. They also let off different types of scents and whatnot, when some danger is coming. There's also, in fact, on nature, they have a beautiful study right now on the sensitivity of plants. So that ahimsa is something, to nurture. We have to nurture it in ourselves, because there's a level of unconsciousness, as though humans are the ones that matter, and we don't even have that, really. But, it's easier maybe to relate to that. We should be kind to all beings, meaning only human beings. But actually, it's much more than that. We should be sensitive to all beings and start to realize that they want to live, and they have emotions, and they care, and they have families, and they try to protect their families. They have love. They have everything. They don't want to be hurt. And you can get by. You can live just fine without hurting them. It's a choice. You don't need to hurt them. Where you have a choice, then you should, ahimsa should be your highest value. In fact, in the value tree of Dharma, the top value is ahimsa. Everything else comes under that. There's the ahimsa, non-injury, then there's the golden rule, and then there's all of the specific situations. So ahimsa, really, even when we start looking, you know, at vaktapas, the control of your speech and the thoughts in your mind and all that, everything comes under this overarching umbrella of ahimsa. And you could even take ahimsa, this non-injury, and put underneath it the sannyasa vow. The sannyasa vow of abhayam, fearlessness. Let no being be afraid of me. Let no being be afraid of me. Even if you just took that one, abhayam, that's enough. That's the great sadhana, let no being be afraid of me. And the other side is just as important. Let me not be afraid of any being. When you contemplate on that one, what that really means is, let me not reject any being. You reject people because of your fear. They're getting in your way in one way or another. So let me have that welcoming, you know, heart. You know, to be open, to be kind. Because why would I reject a person? Because of fear. Because of fear. They're threatening something. They're threatening me in some way.
Yeah.
Right? So we're not usually talking about physical fear. That doesn't come up very often. It may come up, you know. But really, that abhayam, there would be that to deal with too. But pushing people away to really look at, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of by the presence of that person? That abhayam, I want to not be afraid of any person. So let me push no one away, right? And let no being be afraid of me. This Swamiji tells with such pleasure that story. I know I've told it many times, but when after he had taken sannyasa, and he had a lot of students and devotees by this time. He was still a young man. But one devotee was in some trouble, very, very worried, and couldn't sleep, and was just, you know, sometimes when you're just overwhelmed with anxiety and worry, he was so worried that he called Swamiji at 3 in the morning. And he knew he was calling Swamiji at 3 in the morning. Yeah. And Swamiji answered the phone, you know, hello? And this devotee had a story to tell, you know, something really bothering him. So Swamiji listened, and they talked and whatnot, and then a phone conversation came to an end. You know, Swamiji then hung up the phone. And as he went back to lay back to go to sleep, he had this beautiful, wonderful thought that, you know, he was not afraid to call me. He was not afraid to call. And the whole sannyasa vow came back to him, and he felt so happy, you know, that person felt, you know, that he could actually do that, that he could do that, and trusted Swamiji to be able to do that. Swamiji really appreciated that. But it's because it's a beautiful thing. You know when, you know as you have that abhayam, and you know when you don't also. You know? You know when you're a source of fear to others, and you also know when you're not. That's why we're aware of our own growth. It's not like you don't know. As you grow and mature, you're aware of the things that are falling off, and you're you know, aware of the things that are still there also. But as these things fall off, then that's also a joy for you, you know, that these harmful things are not in you anymore, you know. And that's very, very rewarding, because it's more and more growing into your own nature. That is your nature. It means that your mind and who you are is reflecting your being. See, the buddhi, the one that has knowledge, really has jnana nishtha, is speaking for you, is speaking for yourself. It's the voice of yourself. If it has jnana nishtha, it knows you. The self doesn't talk. Your self is always just there, as you are. But the buddhi that has knows you and has nishta, is never away from you, that buddhi is speaking, you know, from you, from your standpoint, the standpoint of the Atman, the standpoint of Ishvara. And that is who you really are. And so there's a tremendous beauty and grace in it. So it means the buddhi is not living within ajnanam anymore. It's not driven by the raga dvesha, but is just a natural expression of yourself. That's what we mean by jnana nishta. So all of these things, you know, like these, as we go through this tapas, these are all the commitments that we make to help us grow into that jnana nishta, into that beautiful, beautiful mind that has antakarana shuddhi. I'm going to stop here because this Bhakti tapas and also the Manasa tapas are really beautiful. I hope you have the handout. Do you have the handout, Vivian?
I do. I brought it home.
Good. Because you should read what Swamiji says, and especially the Bhakti tapas and the Manasa tapas. It's so beautiful. It's just, it just really does it.
So this is the sattvic ones, right?
Well, right now we're going to be looking at them later. Now we're just looking at them in terms of the body, the mind, the tapas. We'll get into sattvic attitude later, three verses after this, these two. Okay? Let's take a moment. Swasti Pajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Maheshaha Go Brahmane Bhishvamastu Nityam Loka Samastha Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Barahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pasyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
sometimes it can be a little scary. You get a little afraid when you, there's these qualities, and you might be going pretty good on most of them, but there's a few bugaboos in there. It's kind of scary approaching them because, you know, if you've been trying for a number of years to be better, and then some of these guys are still just sitting there.
The high-hanging fruit.
She's working on her. Yeah. No, but I mean, you don't, you know they're there and you don't want to approach them is the problem. I mean, there's some fear, you know. There's not that of my own.
Everything in their own time. You have to be patient. It takes courage also. Some things, when you're not ready for them, you're not ready for them, you know. But part of it also is bringing these things to consciousness and learning how to work with them. You know, like sometimes in the guided meditations that we do, how to work with these particular type of feelings, how to work with these inimical people. It's not just one way. There's many ways, and some are easier. Some of the ways are easier than others, and then you can work up to the kind of harder ones. You know, you have to keep working on it, because what else? When we have some of these things that are going on in the mind, really cause pain and worry and fear. And so we have to learn the ways to work with them, and you work with them in effective ways. Part of it is having effective, transformative ways to work with them that actually work, you know, and then to practice them patiently.
Because some of it, you know, you want to avoid. You want to look the other way.
Yeah. But once you're aware of it, that you want to avoid it, that's the beginning of the end. Because now it's come into your sights as something that you need to work on, but you're avoiding, you know. And so then you can take it slowly, you know. There's two emotions, the two hardest emotions, they say, well, there's three, actually, to be with. One very hard one is shame.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a very uncomfortable emotion. So shame.
Yeah.
Guilt. Guilt is not as hard as shame. But the other one that is very hard is fear. Because the fear, we want, by having the emotion of fear, we want to flee,
yeah.
Right? And so a lot of fears that we've picked up along the way will, just by the nature of being fear, cause us to immediately flee. And so you kind of have to talk to yourself and say, let's sit here and experience this fear. It takes some courage, you know. Let me experience this fear. And you, of course, there's a lot of resistance to it, experiencing fear, because fear makes you run away. So let me experience the fear. Shame also. Shame is a very painful emotion, but if you can allow yourself to experience the shame, just sit there and just welcome it. You can welcome the fear, you welcome the shame. I'm saying these two in particular because they're the hardest. Then there's a tremendous transformation that takes place, because after all, it is only an emotion. It's only an emotion. And a lot of these very scary emotions are held inside in the unconscious. You know, and we don't want to experience them again. And so there's a certain knowledge that the buddhi has to have, the mind has to have, to allow you to actually say okay to experience this emotion. And when you're experiencing it, then there's you who are present to this emotion and holding it.
Well, can you necessarily know that it's going to resolve or transform looking at something? It does it by that very process, it does it?
It does do it. And there's a couple of things to know about this. Yourself is always free. Nothing can ever touch it, your being. Right? And so that's not going to be hurt by the emotion that you're feeling. Okay?
Yeah.
The other thing is, if your buddhi is rooted in yourself, then that buddhi, this is one of the advantages of having self-knowledge when you're doing this work. You know, otherwise, you look for kind of the good father, a good parent inside, or the good teacher, the good therapist inside that can do this holding. But the buddhi can be present to this feeling that is only a feeling. And if you can be present to it and welcome it, what happens is the knot of the manas starts relaxing. And then that feeling dissipates because the mind is relaxing. It's all about stress in the mind. So as the mind relaxes, it dissipates. Emotions come and go. If you accept the emotion, then it dissipates, kind of like a cloud. Dispersing, like a dispersing cloud. Yeah. And if it's too scary for you, do it a little bit and then walk away from it. Come back later. You just say, "We'll do this later. It's too hard. I'm sorry. We'll do it later." And come back later and do it.
You know, it's interesting that we've talked before about really the root cause being fear, the root cause of everything negative, really.
Yeah.
But when you say stress in the mind, that's even a root of your cause, it would seem to me.
Fear
is a result of stress in the mind.
Well, the experience of fear is caused by the mind
clenching.
Yeah. There's all different variations that are creating these different emotions that we name. But it has to do with non-welcoming. It has to do with pushing away, with different forms of tightness. So as you relax, you know, then the mind lets go of the stress that's causing that particular emotion.
Something I've always been a little confused about at least when I was in India specifically, about the concentration on saying everything so correctly, like in the mantras, like you were talking about, like them not being mantras if they're not said perfectly.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. Like, wouldn't it be more about the intention or like the thing that you're evoking?
Well, the intention is important too. That's why you can neutralize the mispronunciations by the intention.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know, it's been handed down that way. You know, there's also examples of in Vedic Sanskrit that the swaras are actually a part of the language. And they use an example like, I don't remember, I'm just making this up because I don't remember. Swamiji knows it exactly. If I said something like Indra, that means one thing. If I say Indra like that, it means a different word. It's different. And so say in the Vedic swaras, you're actually, the swaras are instrumental, kind of like in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
The swaras are instrumental in the actual meaning of the word. And in classical Sanskrit, that's not true anymore. The words have come to mean just a specific... Well, gosh, in classical Sanskrit, if you look in the dictionary, the words mean so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
Any given word, right? I wonder if that's because before in Vedic Sanskrit, they lost the swaras that made all these different meanings, you know? I don't know. But in Vedic Sanskrit, it used to be that the swaras were an integral part of the word.
So it made a different meaning. If you change the swara, there would be a different word.
Yeah, exactly.
Swara,
that's all been swara is the tone. Like when we do pula and medha, those are swaras. Then there's things like when we do just the chanting, the ragas, to like Bhagavad Gita, where there's certain ragas that we can use, many different ragas. That's different. Those aren't swaras.
Mm-hmm.
We can chant the Gita in many, many different types of ragas depending on what we want. There's many different ragas that will fit that meter. Yeah. And then there's different shlokas that have a different meter. And then there's a lot of ragas that will fit that meter. You see what I mean? That doesn't matter. Swaras, when we're using swaras, then the meaning, natural meaning, is changed.
I wanted to come back to that when we have, like for instance, fear, like you were saying, is a very powerful, overwhelming emotion.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, you can get so complex around solving the thing that, like, you know, it's like Swamiji says, you know, don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, let Ishwara do it, you know.
Yeah.
It's his creation, including your psychology.
Yeah, that's so true.
You know
true.
What I'm saying? I mean, once you know what it is,
yeah.
To further dig into trying to understand and analyze it is just...
Sometimes, it's just being able to welcome it and accept it and let it work itself out, or to offer it to Ishwara.
Well, that involves some trust.
It does.
Yeah, well...
So, yeah, and so if there's no trust in Ishwara, then that has to be... That's a good prayer. Say, Bhagawan, you know, I don't really believe in you. I don't really trust you. I don't know how to have a relationship with you. But if I could have a relationship with you, this is what I would like it to be. So if you're really there, please help me to develop that shraddha and discover the truth of you. You should say some prayers like that.
Because sometimes sometimes the creation can kick you so hard that, I mean, you're not going back there again.
You should pray that too. If you're there, why'd you kick me so hard? You have to go into some sort of a dial relationship so that you say all of these things that are bothering you. What's the alternative?
There is none.
The alternative is to just say.
No, I don't.
And that's not, that doesn't work either.
No.
That doesn't work.
If you ask and you don't get an answer.
What?
What if you ask and you don't get an answer?
You will get an answer, but maybe not in exactly the form that you want or as quickly as you want.
Well, sometimes asking creates an answer in a way.
Well, it opens up the question and there's no one inside. Once you really ask, then that takes a certain amount of courage and it means your buddhi is open. If you're really asking, your buddhi is open to gain that understanding. And then sometimes it takes a while to gain that understanding, but your buddhi is in a position to gain it.
How come these verses are in... We're talking about the asuras and rakshasahas.
No, now we're looking at the sattva, rajas, and tamas aspect of these different things. We did, you know, shraddha, then we moved to food, then we moved to
rituals.
Now we're at tapas. We're going to go tapas. This is a really interesting one.
Yeah, I see.
Then we're going to go to dana.
So the tone has changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's changing. It's not just asuras now, it's sattva, rajas, and tamas. It's good, you know, it just opens up your mind in a way to just think about things. Think about the territory, think about the way that you're behaving, the way that you're thinking, and what are your values and how to commit to those values and let the ways that you don't live up to those values be your sadhana. It shouldn't be a Vedanta stick.
Mm.
You know, it should be, okay, these are the things I want to work on because they're not living up to my values. Now that I have these values, means let me help me to grow into them. It's kind of like, say you're in sports, if you're a tennis player, you know, you want to be able to have a good serve. Okay, so your drishti, your sankalpa, can be the imagining and visualizing having that serve. But that doesn't mean that you're going to have it right away. You know what it is, you have the value, and you have to work for it. Because there's certain obstacles and things in the way, you know? What if you were to say, oh, what a bummer, I don't have the serve, you know? That's useless. It really makes me angry that I don't have that serve, you know? What's that all about? Why don't I have that serve? Bhagavan didn't treat me right, or I'm no good. Sounds silly. Totally silly. Makes sense when we're talking about sports, right? How can somebody say that? It's like you have to practice. You have to have a commitment.
But there'd be different levels of skill going into such a thing.
That's right. But it doesn't matter if you have the commitment because you have that value. What difference does it make if somebody has more skill than you have, but that's what you want, and then you have to work for it? And there's nothing wrong in that. It's not about saying, oh, look, you're having to work for it. Well, maybe if I was a great tennis player in my last life, then when I'm 2 or 3 years old, like Andre Agassi or somebody, you know, I get an old tennis racket put in my hand when I'm 2 years old.
The racket's bigger than me.
But we come into this life with certain amounts of scars.
Yeah.
Some things we took care of the last life and the life before that. We come into this life with whatever the set of some scars are. We become a mumukshu. And then whatever, you know, whatever things in our mind we have to transform and work on, you know, for the shanti of the mind, for the health of the mind, we do. Whatever you have to work on in terms of your physical body, just for the shanti and the well-being of your body, the health of your body, then you do that. It's all samsara, but it's useful. It's useful to have a healthy body, and it's useful to have, and very pleasing, to have a mind that has some relative shanti because of dharma, you know, and because of transforming the different habits that you've accrued over the, because of your lifestyle and whatever we've accrued in past lives, you've accrued certain things that are pain producing and hurtful. So you work on those things. That's the job. Everybody's job.
Oh, there's no exceptions, huh?
Because everybody is coming out of the same ajnana. You might have different sets of things that you have to work on, that's all.
So you shouldn't feel shame that there's some deficiencies here and there.
I think I don't see anything productive in that, or...
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Not at all. You should just... Say, okay, this is my task. This is what I'm going to work on now.
Because, you know, you're supposed to be like John Wayne, you know? And there I was, walking down the beach with a surfboard.
Well, good old John may not have been a mumukshu like you.
Maybe that's true.
We're all unique. We're all what we are. You're exactly what you're supposed to be. You took this birth. It's your karma, you know? You're a beautiful person. Everybody is.
Well, Swamiji speaks very beautiful about that particular. He has a great commentary on that in the next couple of verses, I think.
Instead of talking the mantra.
Yeah. When he speaks about, you know, you can use the mantra, you know, like what is it? I'm basically I'm okay the way I am. Just, you know.
Yeah, that's what he speaks.
Mantra.
That. Yeah.
You know.
That's when he's talking about the mind. It's very beautiful.
Yes.
I remember reading this before. He does a really beautiful job. It's worth your reading. Yeah. You done?
Yeah.
So we're going to meet again on the 10th of July. We're having class on Saturday for all of you Saturday people. Then we'll meet. This class will be again on July 10th, because I'm leaving Saturday after class. And we go to Sweden and then see Swamiji for a week in India. Yeah. Thursday, July 10th. We'll start up our schedule again.